Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another installment of the Shield Bash podcast. Today's going to be a special episode. We are going to be having a conversation with Mark Greenberg. He is going to be telling us about the Necropolis Kickstarter from Necromancer Games, a part of Frog God Games. It is currently July 25th when we're recording this. This Kickstarter runs until August 21st. I'll put a link in the description. And it is approximately 400% funded at this point. So definitely not something you need to worry about. Not like, are you pledging to it and be like, oh, am I going to get it? No, you're going to get this one. And quite frankly, every time I see Frog God do something, it always seems to just get funded super fast. Mark, why don't you go ahead and tell us a bit about yourself? I've noticed you've got a few credits under your name. Even more, if I was trying to look you up earlier, and if you are a neurosurgeon, you have even more credits than I think. But if you're not a neurosurgeon, because most of the books I could find were about that.
Sadly, I am not a neurosurgeon, although I know a few. But I am not a neurosurgeon. Now, I'm one of the oddballs here who spent most of my life playing the game, DMing for a very long time. I had a real-life job that I did for 26 years, and then I decided, you know, I've had enough. I don't need to do this anymore. And I retired. And at that point, I'd known Bill Webb, who's the principal owner of Frog God and Necromancer Games, for quite some time. And I remember when I posted on Facebook, and I said, yep, I finally pulled the trigger. I'm retiring. He said, how'd you like to write for me? And at this point, I had no credits to my name other than the wacky stuff that I'd done for my job. I was a lawyer, and so I'd been doing that. And so he offered me a chance, and, you know, I actually decided to jump at it. You know, I'd not been on the creative side professionally. You know, I was the DM, like a lot of people, for all the years, and I had
stuck with it, yeah.
And I made multiple campaign worlds that I'd created, and so Bill saddles me with the first project, The World of the Lost Lands, which I forget how many pages. It's a gargantuan thing that you can use to, you know, hold a door open, or I think it'll stop small caliber arms fire from 20 yards, if for some reason you were using it for that. But it basically put together all of the campaign adventures that it had been published under both the Frog God and most of the Necromancer label.
Nice.
And that was a nightmare, and it took me about 2 years. I like to think that it was one of those things. See, the reason Bill asked me was because he'd asked everybody else he knew, and everybody turned him down. But it was a blast, and I finally got to be professionally creative, and now I have a book with my name on it as an author, and it's I think it's a really good work, and there's large parts of it that I wrote on my own. I worked with 6 or 7 authors. It was a huge project. And so then, you know, I'm trying to think what to do next, and Bill actually gave me about 3 or 4 projects I could look at, and but the one he really wanted to do next was Necropolis. And so he sort of sold it to me, maybe wrong. I don't know if Bill's going to listen to this or not. I probably get myself in trouble. He sort of said, oh, yeah, the manuscript's really done. You know, it's just a matter of light editing.
Yeah.
Well,
spoiler alert, that's not the case.
Well, so a little background. I don't know. Most of your listeners may not be familiar with Necropolis. Necropolis is an adventure that Gary Gygax wrote. And he wrote originally for his, I think it was the Dangerous Journeys game system, which didn't last real long, unfortunately. Back in, I think, 92, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's one I know I've never heard of.
Necromancer bought it and republished it as a D20, you know, effectively a 3.0 adventure, D20, back in 2002.
Okay.
And that was what he wanted, you know, what Bill Webb wanted to be redone. But for 5e and Swords and Wizardry. That was my job. And so I started reading the manuscript. And I said, you know, there's more here that needs to be done than just, like, converting. And after talking to the guys, that really wasn't what I thought really they wanted. If you look at the kind of stuff that, like, WotC has done with, Tales from the Yawning Portal, which are basically 5e conversions of original AD&D stuff, or the stuff that I think Goodman Games has done. Those really are, to some extent, just verbatim conversions. Just take the adventure, get rid of the old stats, and put in 5e stats, and call it a day.
That's definitely the easiest way to do it, but...
Oh, it's the easiest way to do it, and I could have done that, but that really wasn't what we wanted here. We really wanted this... It's interesting. You could think of this as two ways. You could either think of it as, hey, let's use this as inspiration, right? And then create something fresh, brand new, completely different. Or you could do a straight conversion. I sort of did the middle ground. And any time somebody says, hey, here's a work by Gary Gygax, you know, rewrite it. There's a little bit of like a, you know, wow, really? You think I'm going to improve on this? But that's, you know, I guess, you know, I decided not to be afraid of that and really did take it very seriously as a task to... I don't want to say re-envision, but totally revise, update, make it work a lot more like modern adventures is to how people are writing adventures now, not how they were being written in 1992.
So it was an
interesting process, and it's taken, again, many, many months. I can't remember when I started, but it's probably been a good year, actually, that I've been working on it, all told.
And it's definitely a good idea. I know, being in the hobby, some of the things I've read have talked about how pre-generated adventures are just a lot more popular now than they used to be when the hobby started, because it's just A, available, B, you know, people are busy and don't have time to, you know, a lot of them don't have time to build this stuff up. So, like, changing it around some, getting it up to where people wanted. It's, you know, if they don't like it all, you know, everybody knows you can always just change stuff that you don't like anyway. So it seems like a cool day, and it would be daunting, I think, like, to be given something written by, you know, Gary Gygax and be like, hey, this is what you're rewriting, and just be like, I don't know that I have the chops to. Like, if it was me personally, I'd be like, I don't have the chops to do this. Like, I'm not gonna touch this.
Well, you know, Gary. Yeah, you know, I mean, look, you know, as they say, you know, it's always dangerous to put your heroes on a pedestal. Gary had, he is the co-creator of this game. Everything that we all do in many ways dates back to what he and Dave Arneson created, things have changed. You know, the world has changed, and you know, some of the ways that the game used to be played, that's just not how, you know, people want to play it. I do find it interesting. I mean, I actually, the irony is you know, as a you know younger DM, I almost never played, you know, existing modules, existing adventures. I created everything on my own. Mm-hmm. That was sort of what I did. The only time I would do a published adventure was really where one of my friends wanted to do sort of a one-off. You know, somebody'd say, hey, you want to run me through, you know, this adventure. I heard this is a lot of fun from somebody, and that either I'd buy it or I'd get a copy or somehow I'd finagle a copy and I'd run it. But I never made it part of really my sort of general gaming experience. But I think you're right. I mean, it's one thing when you're in high school or even in college to do that, but especially once you get like a real job and get into the workforce, the time to actually create your own campaign world and your own adventures becomes much more limited. It just does. And so having good resources is valuable. That being said, nobody, I would hope, would go out there and say, hey, I'm just going to grab this published module, read it once and then just play it exactly as written. Because you got to tailor it for your players. You got to change things you don't like. And that's sort of how I approached, Gary's work, in a sense, was, what do I not like? What doesn't work for me? And there were aspects of it that I really did feel like, back in the day, I think the DM was much more interventionist. They were almost, it was almost a sense of the players against the GM, the DM. And I think Gary wrote to some extent that way. And anybody who's read Tomb of Horrors knows exactly what I mean. That is an effort, to see whether or not the DM can crush the life out of a bunch of players. And I think Gary admitted that's why he wrote it. He was trying to do that. That's not my style, and I think that's not mostly the modern style. The modern style is the GM is, a neutral arbitrator, and simply is making decisions as you go along, like an umpire. That may not always be true, but at least that's the model, right? That's the ideal. And so I tried to look at it from that perspective, and instead of and if anybody has the original versions, you can see this, where Gary basically writes something like, the party needs to do X next, and it is your job as the DM to make sure that the party does X next. And if they don't, here are some tools you can use to force them. And that's not really a good solution in my view. And so instead, what I really did was look at it as an opportunity to focus on the motivations. What are the characters' motivations? What are the players' motivations? Why are they playing this? What's going on? And how can I create, instead of forcing the party's hand, how can I instead create a situation where they're likely to do the right thing because the hints are there, the facts are there, and a well-run party, players we're thinking we'll find the right solution, just like any good trick or trap or something, on a more limited sense. So I sort of looked at it as an overall sense like that.
That's a good way to approach it. There's a lot of nuggets in there that that are very important. Because when I started gaming, I had a very similar experience. I was early 20s when I started GMing, and I created my own homebrew world and was running all these just adventures. I would like to say that I wrote them all ahead of time, but a lot of them were just like, oh yeah, we're gaming today. Here we go. And then, the past couple years, full-time job, two kids, the podcast, like it's adventure paths and modules. Like it's just, I don't have time to sit down and write out all this stuff. But you're also right. The stuff that I run, it's a skeleton, you know, it's even the ones that are super well written where it's just like, this is why they're here and this is what they're doing. And it's like, well, no, this is the event that I'm going to use and we're going to they have a completely different reason to be here because that doesn't make, just morphing it all.
Yep.
And you're doing it because when it was originally written for a completely different system, and then you guys bought it and released it as a D20 system. But even then, now you're updating it into two different systems.
Right.
Things are going to have to change. There's no way that you can keep it all the same, even if it's, just some of the little things. Because I imagine there's some mechanics in there that you have to look at and be like, well, that just doesn't even exist anymore.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. There are certain ways that, you know, whether it was spells, whether it was, you know, how various aspects worked. You know, I remember there's one encounter where effectively, you know, the way it was written, the party was supposed to be forced by a monster encounter into a specific passage. And I realized that what he had written was not powerful enough to force the party to go anywhere. They would just go into combat and kill them.
Yep.
So that wasn't going to work. So I had to find different motivations. That being said, there are areas that the players can skip right over and it's not going to be an issue. There's other areas they can skip right over and it's going to be a problem. And part of that was trying to find the motivations for the party. But I mean, there's a lot of nuggets in here. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, and I've, Gary clearly did a huge amount of research on Egyptian mythology. If it isn't clear, Necropolis is an Egyptian themed adventure. It was originally written for, I forget the name of the campaign world that Gary was creating at the time, but it was Aegyptus, I think. So spelled A-E-G-Y. Where it has been slotted into the, and this is now part of the Lost Lands, which is the world of Fraggad and Necromancer. It's in the country of Kemet, the Triple Kingdom of Kemet, which is of course an ancient name for Egypt that was used. And if you look at the map, and there will be a map, it looks a whole heck of a lot like ancient Egypt, but which was, you know, and Gary did a huge amount of research. I tried to honor that and keep that. And there were still things I changed, which meant I had to pull out, you know, some Egyptian books that I had. I discovered that a copy of the Book of the Dead that I was able to use, and try to come up with some interesting alternatives to some of the stuff that he did. So I wanted to honor that part. But you're right. I mean, there were things that just had to change for no other reason than system. But there were other things that I just felt, like I said, in addition to motivations, I mean, even in some of the encounter locations, I kind of felt like some of the rooms just got short shrift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, why is this here? And there'd be three rooms that were kind of similar and not very different. And, you know, I came up with something totally different to be in those rooms.
Oh, that's good.
You know, that I thought was interesting. So, like I said, this is. People ask, you know, how based is this on Gary's original works? And I guess there are some people who've read it and really love it, and that's great. You know, and they're a little concerned that I've done some major harm to it, or that it's going to be something totally different. It's not, in the sense that the plot is the same, most of the characters are the same, but how you get there, some of the motivations, what's really going on in the background, some of those things have changed because I felt that you could update those and make it a little more like how we currently play the game. That all being said, if you wanted to take one of these encounter locations and drop it into a your own campaign world, there's a lot of cool stuff in here that could be used like that too, which is something that, again, most DMs, you know, will often do, right? You know, you sort of get, yeah, get to a point where you don't know what to do for your next encounter, and you go and you steal something or borrow something. Let me rephrase that.
We can say steal. That's fine. that's totally legit. Any GM, I've once heard it said, and I agree with it, the best GMs are the ones who steal the most, and the most creative GMs are the ones who steal from the most obscure places.
Yes.
So
that's exactly right.
And I will say this, too, for those listeners, if you are one of those listeners who is concerned about the changes made, think about it like this. Think about it like if you go to see a play, and then you go see the same play at a different place. I've seen Midsummer Night's Dream like four times, and it has never been the same. Each one is just
right.
And it, quite frankly, if they'd all been the same, holy crap, that would have been boring. But this is a chance for you to relive a story that you loved and not know exactly what's going to happen.
And really not know, because if you play some of the rooms the same way, you're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Surprise!
Yeah. which was part of the point. Yeah. You know, you want to be surprised. But like I said, I also thought that there were some things that we could do that would be fun. There's a couple of encounters that I'm really proud of. I think they're really fun and challenging and potentially extraordinarily deadly. I mean, this was supposed to be a challenging adventure. And I would say I've play tested it quite a bit at this point. And I used my home group, they're pretty good. And they blew through certain parts easily. But, you know, where we left it off, we never actually did finish because this is huge. I mean, you know, we didn't have enough time even as a game group while I was writing it to a regular gaming group to playtest the whole thing. But I'm pretty sure the last encounter was a TPK. You know, it's and people say, oh, it's 5e, you can't kill a party. Oh, yeah? you can kill a party of 5e characters in Necropolis if they are not playing carefully, if they're not being thoughtful. And even if they are, you still may kill them off.
Yeah. You know, I've heard the same thing, heard about the Starfinder system, where it's like, oh, it's Starfinder, you can't kill characters in Starfinder. And I've listened to enough podcasts where people have died that I know that, I've seen it happen.
Yep. And that's not to suggest that that's a good thing or that the DM should be trying to do that. It's simply a statement that if there really is no peril of failure, there's no fun in the game. And part of that is having the peril, but it's also having realistic chances to figure out what the right answer is. And anybody who's read some of Gary's earlier stuff, like Tomb of Horrors, knows that, you know, one of the things he was fond of was, to use a simple example, there's a lever in a room. And if you push it in one direction, treasure comes pouring out of the ceiling. And if you push it in the other direction, everybody is hit by a disintegration. And there's no way to figure out which is which. I hate that, those.
Yeah. While that may be realistic from like an esoteric view, where if you're actually, you know, designing a dungeon to kill people, but it's not a fun game.
Right, exactly. You know? So like,
I hate enchantment spells. Like, I hate losing control of my character. They're all over the rule books. Every system has them. But I don't use them because I hate it when they're used on me. So it's just like,
yeah.
Is it realistic? Yes. Mind control is a big thing of magic. But it's not fun.
Yep. No, I hear you. I hear you. I will not comment on whether that's applicable or not in Necropolis. So maybe you wouldn't find it fun. Maybe you would. I would note that as a general matter, like in those places where Gary wrote the, you know, do one thing, you success, do another thing, failure, I always tried to build in something that if you're observant, if you're cautious, you should be able to figure out which the right answer is. I think I did leave one because I didn't think it was a killer, but it was certainly painful. Right, I did leave it. You know what? In homage to the original writer, I will leave this in here. But as a general matter, you should be able to figure it out if you're thoughtful. Now, if you just bumble along and you say, okay, well, you know, I'm gonna open the door and I'm not gonna, you know, listen at it or check for traps. Hey, that's your right. You can do that, but you know.
Yeah, let the players feel clever.
Well, and then they should be, right? You know, I mean, that's part of why you play the game, right? Part of it is, you know, it isn't just to see who can roll the most, you know, high numbers on a, you know, 20-sided die. It's, you know, can you outthink the opposition? Can you, and there's a lot, the other thing I should mention is there's a lot of opportunities in the, I'd say the first two-thirds of this book for real role-playing.
Oh, that's good.
This is not just a, you know, let's, you know, find somebody and either kill them or befriend them, and or, you know, bash through doors. There's a lot of opportunities for role playing, and I think that's something that, again, and that was partially in the original, but I tried to enhance it because that's also part of it, right? It's getting the chance to experience, you know, the culture, the environment, meet people, learn more about it. And there's a lot of background that I've tried to build into the book that even somebody who doesn't know much about Egyptian mythology should be able to run the adventure and, you know, make it a really interesting locale. And that's also part of it, right? I mean, you know, how many of the games do we play are effectively in some version of, Middle Ages Europe, you know, or some high fantasy version of that. And this is a chance to play in a different environment that's familiar enough, though, that most people know who, you know, Ra and Horus and Osiris and Set are. So you're not completely at sea.
Does it use the actual, like, Egyptian pantheon and culture and everything? Or is it like, okay, what's the example? Okay, so Magic the Gathering had one of their magic sets that was all Vikings. Right. And it's like, okay, this is obviously Loki, but it's, you know, it's a different name. Like, this is obviously Odin, but it's a different name. Or, like, which have you got here?
Yeah, so in this case, as a general matter, it uses the same names. So, you know, there is a location, and this is not a spoiler, because if you read the Kickstarter page, there is something called the Temple of Osiris.
There you go.
Now, there are details built in that relate specifically to Osiris that your casual, you know, if you've seen the Ten Commandments, for example, you know, you're not going to know.
Yeah.
Now, you know, you might know it, but, and if you don't, you know, you can always ask a question of the DM and make a religion check, right? You know, if you want to know something about, you know, what are the aspects of Osiris that I should know, that my character might know. And depending upon who you are, you know, they'll pick the appropriate DC. A lot of that's, some of that's built in where it's designed, but some of it is where the DM will just have to show some flexibility. So in that regard, it should be relatively easy for somebody to feel like they're fitting in, but it also will feel very different than, you know, your standard, you know, as I said, sort of medieval European adventure or high fantasy type adventure.
Gotcha. So I know because I play Pathfinder, right? And I know in the Pathfinder setting they have Osirian, which is like Egypt, you know, they don't even make a secret of it. They also use the ancient pantheon of Egypt.
Yep.
But let's say I am running the high fantasy Europe or some sort of gothic horror story or something in between. How easy would it be for somebody who got in a crop of this, because they're like, I really want to do this, but my party is in, you know, a steampunk Western.
Yep.
How easy is it for them to take this and plop it down into a different setting and, like, be able to change it? Like, okay, right, it's not the Temple of Osiris, it's the Temple of Jeff the Cannon Man, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple things that obviously, you know, one can do depending upon how much work the DM wants to do, right? The World of the Lost Lands, for example, is you know, has two continents. Akkados is basically your, you know, with some exceptions, is basically your Western European medieval high fantasy continent. And then you've got the continent of Libanos, which you can already see the derivation from, because that comes from Libya, which was originally part of the name for, I think all of Africa originally. And, you know, that's got the triple kingdom of Kemet, so the Egyptian culture. So one option is to simply decide you're going to build this culture in. And there's a map and there's enough information that if you literally wanted to put this somewhere in your campaign world and it fit, you could. And, you know, I mean, obviously there are some different levels of technology. Like if you're playing steampunk, you might have, you know, some sort of revolvers or electricity guns or something that, you know, wouldn't necessarily easily fit within sort of your standard 5e, but you could find a way to make that work. You know, that wouldn't be that hard. You know, could you take this whole thing and drop it in and effectively strip out the Egyptian aspects? I think you could. I mean, to be honest, I mean, a tomb is a tomb is a tomb, right? There are some aspects you'd have to think carefully about, because, as I said, Gary did a lot of research, and I did a lot of research trying to be consistent. And so, for example, there are aspects about which direction tombs face that was very specific to Egyptian tradition, and we retained that for this adventure. Yeah, big deal. You know, you want to get rid of it, change the cardinal direction, or just that just happens to be the way it was oriented, and who cares, right?
Do you have are any of the puzzles or solutions tied into the mythos, or is it just super strong flavor?
It's very, very strong flavor. There are a couple places I can think of where you might have to reskin it a bit. There are some aspects that are also quite unique to Egyptian mythology and Egyptian the Egyptian view of the underworld, or the Duat. But you could easily say, well, this is also true of the underworld or death in my world or in this particular culture, in a way that you could. And again, some of this is so obscure that your average person may not even realize that this is Egyptian.
Gotcha.
And so if you just carry it over into your own campaign world, and you just rename some things, instead of Set, you got a different god of evil, right? Instead of Osiris or instead of Ra, you've got a different god of the sun. I'm not going to suggest that it won't take work, but most of what's in there does not necessarily require somebody to say, well, this has to be Egyptian. And in many ways, because the research is so deep, that most people will not go, oh, wait a minute, that's an Egyptian concept. How did that get here? So you could do it. I happen to think it's a lot of fun using it as it is, just because, to be honest, I learned quite a bit, both through the research, that was in the original version and the additional work I had to do that I had no idea about. And I would tell that what that is, but that would be a spoiler. And I don't want to give away spoilers here in case somebody wants to play this game without knowing really anything. But that's what I'd say about that.
Yeah. So. I'm just trying to look up reason, trying to get rid of excuses why people shouldn't get it. Yeah. I don't want somebody sitting here being like, well, I don't think I'd be too interested in you. No.
Yeah.
You can use this necropolis anywhere you want.
Yeah. And it's a necropolis, right? And, people of all sorts of cultures bury their dead in tombs.
Yep.
It's not that unusual. I think the other thing, I would also say is what also makes this unusual is there aren't a lot of stuff out there for higher level characters.
Oh.
And we pitch this. What we describe this is the party should really start, I would say, somewhere between 7th and 9th level. From a 5e perspective. It depends upon how many players you have. I ran it with, I can't remember if it was 6 or 8. I think a couple of the playtests were actually with 8. A couple were with 6. And I started at 7th, 8th level. By the time they get into the sort of the last area, I recommend that they all be 10th. And you could, and 11th would not be out of the question. And you could finish this adventure if you survive 12th, 13th, maybe even 14th level, and still have a real challenge at the very end. The original adventure in D20, I think, was something like for 4 to 8 characters of 10th to 18th level, and I thought that was a little on the... First of all, that's a ridiculous range of 10th to 18th. Once you get to 18th level in 5e, you're casting awfully powerful spells. And I'm frankly, there's a sweet spot to the system. I happen to think it's right around 10th level. That's the level I've enjoyed both playing and DMing at. And I think that's a good level for this. So it gives you a chance to do something that's more challenging. But again, it's not just the characters, it's the players. You got to be thoughtful. You know, characters will die if they just start bumbling around. I don't care what level you are.
And I noticed in your guys' Kickstarter, you're also giving out, but you can also get the files, I guess, to like put this into virtual tabletops and everything like that. So it's like, you mentioned earlier about like the work putting into like potentially revamp it for other things. That's a huge work saver. Like just being able to load up like, oh, we're playing virtually and, you know, especially like, is it big maps? Like, are the encounter areas big?
Well, it all depends. And I should note, you know, we really put a lot of thought into what would be the stretch goals, what would be, you know, in each of the different categories, because we've all seen too many Kickstarters that go sideways, right? You know, we did not want stretch goals or you know, bells and whistles that were going to keep us from performing this thing. You know, Frog God is committed to get this stuff and get it out. And in high quality. I mean, if anybody owns any of their books, they're solid, library-bound, well-packaged. If your book shows up and it's been run over by, you know, the UPS, they'll make it good. You know, they'll send you a replacement. But we want to make sure we can perform. But we also want to add things that have real value. And obviously, you know, especially during the pandemic, you know, I, like a lot of people, I went to all virtual gaming. You know, we couldn't get together. And in some ways, it was actually more convenient because we didn't have to drive to anybody's house. You know, anytime, you know, the people that I play with, some of us live fairly distant, you know, 40-minute, half an hour drive, depending upon, you know, traffic.
I hear
and, you know, all of a sudden it's like, no, we can all hop on, you know, a Zoom and hop off, and it was great. So I think obviously, you know, and other advantages, we could have people playing from all around the country, in theory of the world, right?
Yeah.
Other than time difference. So that seems to be important. And so we've got two VTT virtual tabletop platforms that we are supporting. One is generic, and I'm going to draw a blank on the other one. You can probably pull it up for me and tell me.
I think it was it Fantasy Grounds?
That sounds right.
Fantasy Grounds, Unity 5e, and the VTT asset pack. Yeah.
Yep. So we've engaged, you know, the real guys to put this together. And so you're going to have all the maps, you know, for Fantasy Grounds, for 5e, it's going to be really, really powerful. You know, the asset pack is platform independent, so it won't be quite as powerful. So if you're not running 5e, if you're running Swords and Wizardry, for example, you try to do, you know, your own conversion to Pathfinder or something, then it won't be quite as effective. But for 5e, it's going to have all the bells and whistles. And there's already a bunch of maps. I can, you know, I don't think it's probably a big surprise, but there's a village that you start in, so there's going to be a village map. There is, as I said, a Temple of Osiris. There are lots of tombs. There is potentially a final tomb. Actually, I shouldn't say potentially. Anybody who knows Alyssa Fade, who is one of the outstanding cartographers, has done the tomb of Rahotep. She has been streaming it live originally it was on Twitch, and I think recently she's gone over to streaming on YouTube, and she streamed the mapping of it, and I think you can get it all recorded versions. It's just insanely amazing, and I forget what the actual size is. It is gargantuan, and the details, and she's hidden Easter eggs in it. It's just insane. And so all that's going to be available, And obviously, if you're using fantasy grounds, you know, you've got the direct line of sight lighting and all that kind of stuff that built into it that just makes it incredibly powerful. So I think that's, you know, I have to admit, I'm not a fantasy grounds, you know, I when I was doing it remote, I'd use the whiteboard on Zoom, and that was good enough for me. But for people who use Fantasy Grounds or any virtual tabletop, this is going to be a huge benefit. And that's one of the reasons why you know, we thought we needed to add this, because, you know, even though, you know, knock on wood, we're going to get close to the end of this thing, if not there for many folks, I think remote gaming is going to keep going. It's going to, you know, there's a lot of reasons to keep doing it. Even if some people are in the same room, you might want to, you know, do it where somebody from out of town can still participate. So yeah. We thought that was going to be a really good option. And all the other stretch goals that we've built in really were designed to try to enhance that. And so, you know, I think we've already hit a whole bunch of them, but we're creating some sample encounter areas, right? So, for example, you know, you're at some random location in the desert. You know, and you know, you roll and there's a random encounter, you've got a bonus map now that you can use that you'll be able to run the encounter on.
Yeah, I'm looking at a lot of these. You've got three different maps: the desert encounter, desert campsite, and the
gorge of Osiris.
Yeah, which exactly. Just sounds cool. And you know, there's just all sorts of other stretch goals set up for other points, like, but you guys have hit so many because you funded so much.
There's a lot of great fans, you know, and I appreciate that. I think, you know, fans of the original adventure and folks who are just big fans of Frog God and Necromancer, because they know the quality of the stuff, they know the quality of the books, they know the quality of the writing. And that's huge. And so I'm thrilled. You know, I would love to see this go sky high, though, because, you know, there's still some ideas I have for stretch goals that, you know, I've already been told, yeah, unless we get to a really high number, it just doesn't make economic sense. And look, I'm the creative guy here. You know, I'm not I'm not the business guy, you know. I did that for my career. So, you know, what makes sense economically? Fundamentally, look, these game companies still have to make money, right? You know, it's still got to make sense. But if you get to a certain point, you can do some really creative, interesting things. So I'm really hoping we get to, you know, to an insanely high level. But if not, I think this is still going to be a phenomenal product, and there's a lot of value. And my guess is we'll hit probably all the stretch goals we currently have listed. I would absolutely expect that to be the case. So I will tell you, you know, my first Kickstarter for Frog God was The World of the Lost Lands. And I got to tell you something. I was petrified when the thing went live. And I don't know that you know, from the outside, you know, I backed a lot of Kickstarters. I've been a consumer of this stuff for a long time. And, you know, somebody's Kickstarter would go live. I'd look at it. It was somebody I knew or somebody I really liked. I might immediately back it. Otherwise, I'd pay attention to it. And then, you know, when I got one of the final notices, maybe I'd think about backing it or something. But it was sort of no big deal. First time when I was involved in a Kickstarter and went live, I was scared shitless. It's like all of a sudden, this is real. Yeah. And all these backers expect that this product is going to be delivered on time, in good quality, and they're going to like it. And it's one thing when you're sitting around the table with your five or six friends and you're the DM and you've created an encounter and somebody later says, yeah, that, you know, that didn't go quite as well as it could have. It's a different thing if, you know, hundreds and hundreds of strangers or thousands of strangers say, wow, that really sucked. You don't want that to happen.
No, you really don't.
So, but I gotta be honest. I mean, this time, you know, ultimately, World of Lost Lands worked out great. I'm incredibly proud of it, and I'm really proud of this one too. I think anybody who buys it is gonna enjoy it. If you run it, I think it's gonna be a blast. And if you just want to use it to steal some ideas to throw, whether it's a trap or an encounter, or I mean, there's like 50 something, or there's like around 50 new monsters in this. Now most of them were in the original, not all of them. Most of them were in the original D20. But they were never otherwise published anywhere else, and we've updated them all for 5e.
Very cool.
So they could be used for any number of things. I don't even know how many total NPCs there are, with character descriptions. I mean, it really is. It's a huge product. I think we're around 160,000 words, somewhere in that range. Which, for those who know, that's a big volume. And then of course we got all the new artwork we've commissioned.
Maps.
Look at the Kickstarter. All new maps. We've got we've already gotten beyond the early backer, unfortunately, but you'll still get a PDF of it. We've commissioned Cave Geek to do the a player's map that you can get. And
cool. That is a great idea.
I've been looking at the work that Kafir Mendel has done, and it is just, I mean, you know, I look at these things, and, you know, I'm pretty good with the written word. I suck at art. You know, I'm the guy who draws the stick figures, and I am just floored at the talent that these artists bring to envisioning something. You know, one of the real pleasures of creating is having this idea in your head, writing it down, and then having somebody go, "You mean like this?" It's like, "Yes, that's exactly what I meant. That's exactly what I meant." Or sometimes it's, "That's not what I meant. That's cooler than what I meant." and I'm going to change. There's actually, talking earlier about Alyssa Fade, and she hides Easter eggs in her maps, and most of them I just let go. But there was one area where she filled in some areas and put some stuff in, and it wasn't in my text. And I'm like, what did you do? She's like, "I thought it was boring, so I added this." It's like she said, "Look, don't worry about it. You don't have to do anything about it. It's just there. You know, it's sort of an Easter egg." I said, no, you don't understand. I think that's really cool, and I'm going to now explain what that means. And so it was like, you know, I got to collaborate effectively, and she put something in her map that I was then able to add to the text that isn't in the original and was kind of wacky and fun. This stuff is amazing. It really is. And so I think anybody who gets this, you know, the art is going to be incredible in the book. You know, we're going to be giving these customer appreciation cards out that will have bits of the art on it. God willing, we'll get a whole bunch of those in stretch goals, and somebody will get a nice stack of cards with just really awesome art. Yeah. That's my hope anyway.
And listeners, we just want to be clear on one thing. If you do have a problem with the Kickstarter, and by that I mean, like, it doesn't ship on time, it, you know, gets lost in the mail, your book arrives damaged, it is not on Mark.
No.
Mark wrote it. He designed it. He's not handling fulfillment. So if something goes wrong, do not try to be like, tweeting at Mark Greenberg, like, "Hey, my book's all jacked up, and it... blah, 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 blah." He's not going to be able to do much besides to point you towards somebody else entirely.
That's exactly right. However, I would note that the frogs are really good about that. I know one guy in Canada who kept getting shipped his book. This is one of the reasons why, unfortunately, international fulfillment is different now. And this is one of the reasons. I think they ended up shipping the same book to him 4 times before it finally arrived undamaged. Something just kept happening between the U.S. and Canada. And so one of the unfortunate parts, and I'm hoping that someday this will be solved, and I think all Kickstarters, you know, anybody who backs a Kickstarter knows this, international delivery is an issue for American publishers. It's a huge problem. Yeah. And so that's one of the reasons why for international backers, it's going to be locally printed, print on demand, and a lot of the physical options are not available.
Yeah.
Because we just can't... we can't rely on international shipping for this kind of stuff, unfortunately. And as many people now also know, it's so outrageously expensive that it almost makes it uneconomic for a buyer. Now, if you're international and you really want something and you want it physical, maybe you have a friend in the U.S. who can back for you and
ship it up to themselves.
We'll either ship it to you. Or maybe if you come for a convention or something into the U.S., you can pick it up then or something.
So I will say most of the Kickstarters I've seen who are publishing books, they don't even offer international stuff. It's like you're just going to get the PDF. That's it. It's the only option you have. So
yeah.
It's cool that you even have the print-on-demand options.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame because... but it is what it is, unfortunately, right now. And, we keep hoping that it will change, but... it's the best we can do, and we really want to make sure we're delivering a really top quality product. I mean, these hardback books, available in the U.S., they're not going anywhere. They're not, pages are not going to fall out of these things.
Yeah.
They are really, they're built to last a generation. So, if you're worried about that, you're getting a good quality book, and and that's what I want, right? I don't want the stuff that I spent all this time creating, to fall apart on people.
Oh, so, yeah, especially since yeah. I mean, if you're getting this book, it's something you're gonna use. You're gonna be in and out of it a whole lot just to run it, especially as big as it is, 50 unreleased monsters, it's not like you can be like, oh yeah, no, I know what this does, so I don't need to really look. No, you're going to have that book open. You're going to be in it. I noticed you guys even offer some leather bound ones, which are going to be even nicer.
Oh yeah. I've got some of those, as well. So if you want to back at the highest levels, you got a leather bound book, which is a nice, I mean, it's pretty. It obviously won't have the color cover, which by the way is an awesome, but it's still nice to have the leather bound. And I think at the top three levels, you can get a GM screen,
cool.
Which is not necessary to play, but what it does is it brings together a lot of the things that if you're running the adventure, it would be really convenient to have right in front of you. So it's going to have like the wilderness outdoor encounter tables, it's going to have weather tables, it's going to have there's some aspects of in the adventure, I want to be careful here, that the DM really needs to keep very close track of as time goes on, and it's helpful to have that information right in front.
That's nice.
And so that's also going to be on there. And I think we're probably going to add, I may add some things like a handy list of the major deities. So if you have to think of a god off the top of your head, or you're not sure which one is the god of whatever, because let's be honest, some of these are, we all know Ra and Osiris and Horus and Set. There's a lot of other ones that are relevant actually here that, if you don't know. So, but, for various reasons, the GM screen is only, it's not available as an add-on, so you can't buy it later. Not available as a stretch goal. It's only available to the highest backers. So it's one of the things that if you can afford to back at that level, it will be really cool. But I will say that if you can't, it's not like it makes the game unplayable or anything. You may just need to photocopy some pages, which again, because of the way these books are built, you can photocopy pages and not have the thing fall apart at the binding.
That's nice.
So
you could do this cool thing on there, like you could dedicate one of the panels to have like the gods and like how they're connected to each other, and too, so then, because I'm sure that wouldn't be confusing with the Egyptian pantheon and all the
Oh yeah, yeah. All we could have one of those. They do a Venn diagram of Egyptian gods or something.
Yeah.
That would be fun. That would be fun. Or maybe not.
Yeah, I mean. You just would have to color code it so it would be moderately less confusing. I don't know. Yeah, adding their relationships is probably just going to be more confusing than anything else. But I did actually notice, like, right on the top of your Kickstarter is a quote, "So says the priests of Toth." So that God of knowledge is at least mixed into things.
Oh, no, there's some interesting aspects of history, which are, you know, again, Lost Lands specific, but, you know, you can play around with that to your heart's content. But yeah, it's like I said, it was a lot of fun building this and taking what originally had been done, expanding it and building in my own ideas. So it was a lot of fun.
It sounds like it. And it sounds like it'd be a lot of fun to play.
I sure hope so. You know, as I said, I've run it a number of times so far. Everybody who played, maybe they were being kind to me, but they all said they enjoyed it. I think most of the ones that I know of, who I know well enough to know by name, because I did some play testing for Frog God Head, like a Frog God Game Day a while ago, and so I tended to know people by screen name. We did that over Discord. And those guys had a good time, but the ones who I know, I think everybody's backed it, which I think is a really good sign, frankly. I view it as an honor. I view it as an honor to have the opportunity to do this and to bring something out there to people that will hopefully, you know, bring people many hours of fun. That's what I hope anyway. God, that sounded like way too serious. I'm sorry. Wow.
No. I mean, it's important. That's the whole point of this whole thing. Like, DMing is a lot of work, and creating all of the stuff when you're DMing. Even like I mentioned, I run a lot of pre-generated stuff, but I still have to like read it to know what's going on, and then I have to figure out like, okay. You know, back to that why. Like, why are the characters here and stuff? Why do the characters care? Like, right. I have to adjust things. Like, this NPC, it was just generic dude. And it's like, okay, how do I make the characters care about him? And, you know, all that work that you do, it's important to you because, like, you put a lot of effort into it.
Yep.
And, I mean, if you put that much effort, if you took something that was so important to so many people and from somebody who a lot of people really respect, and you yourself put what you said like a year of work into it, and now, like, I mean, it's got to be gratifying to see that you funded so quickly.
Yeah,
you know, because that's not just Frog God Games. Like, I know their stuff funds fast, but I remember we did an interview for, and I'm struggling to remember the name, but it was basically the Mesoamerican setting.
Twaddle. Twaddle.
Yeah, that one. I remember it started with a T, but it was also a verb. Mm-hmm. That one funded, but it didn't fund like this. It wasn't 500% in 3 days, you know? So, like, that means that people are looking at this and their people are excited about it.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like you should be proud. You should be excited. Well, and I appreciate it should be that. Serious because you put a lot, you put a year of your life into this, and obviously people are responding to it. So congratulations, man.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, and I hope that's right. And you know, look, I view it as a responsibility, right? I always want to make sure that when people get this thing, they're going to be really happy with it, and they'll play it. You know, one of the saddest things for me, I'm a bit of a old game collector, and yes, I have some things in shrink wrap that I will probably never open. But in some respects, that's just sad, right? You know, these are games; they're meant to be played. And I want to have people come up to me at one of these cons and say, hey, I pulled out, you know, Necropolis, and I ran this, you know, for my friends, and they had a really good time.
Yeah.
That's what this is all about. I mean, as you probably know, nobody gets rich, with the possible exception of Wizards of the Coast, you know, publishing role playing games.
Yeah.
You know,
Wizards is rich because of magic at this point.
That's right. Although D&D is apparently a moneymaker for them, which, and I think that's, to my mind, that's phenomenal because it supports the rest of the industry.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of the other companies, you know, are trying to be profitable, trying to make some money for the people who own it, but nobody's getting rich. Everybody that I know in this business, pretty much without exception, well, there's a couple of exceptions, but almost all of them have other jobs. They made their money somewhere else, and they happen to also own a game company,
yeah,
which is certainly the case with Frog God. Ultimately, the goal here is to create something that people have fun with and enjoy playing, and that's I think people do, and I think hopefully people will with this. And I don't mean to sound so I don't know, saccharine about it, but you know, I want people to play this thing, and I want people to have fun with it. That's what it's all about. Yeah. So.
Well, I'm excited for it, and I'm excited, you know, for you and for the whole product. You know, you definitely sounds like the sort of thing that, you know, maybe you set up a weekend long table at a GaryCon or something to have people come and sit down and try to get through it before the convention's over.
Well, you know, there is no way. I ran my home group through this. And I did it episodically because there are certain areas I really wanted to playtest. I don't think we played 5 or 6 sessions. I can't remember. And even episodically, we didn't get anywhere near finishing all the material. I mean, you could take Necropolis, and this is where I think you could excerpt like one of the tombs or a temple or something or a little bit of an area and add it to your home campaign and play it and then move on. If you want to play this whole thing out, you've got the material for, you know, I would say, you know, unless you guys are playing like every other day, this is months of gaming material potentially.
Sounds like a selling point to me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of value in this. If you want to run a long campaign, you know, I don't think there's any way for somebody to just jam through it. There really isn't, because if you try, you will fail, and you'll probably get your party killed because you're not being thoughtful enough. You're not being careful. You're not interacting with enough NPCs. You know, you're not doing what you should be doing. You know, and again, it's all built into the motivation. So I there's a lot of material here, and I think anybody who buys it is going to get way more than their money is worth. I really do.
I feel like we've covered most of the topics. Is there any closing statement or anything, any final thoughts that you want to get out there just to say, like, okay, you know, this is the like deep inside in my heart and soul, this is what I feel about this. This is the 5 words or less, or, you know, 500 words of like of Necropolis.
500, yeah, 5 words or less. There's no way I can't do anything in 5 words or less. You know, we really covered a lot of it. I mean, you know, like I said, I was a consumer for a very long time. I bought other people's stuff. I read other people's stuff, and I used it as a DM. And that's sort of the model I came at this from. You know, if I were sitting at the other end of this book trying to figure out what the heck am I going to do with this thing? How am I going to play it? What do I need to know? What would I have fun doing? That's sort of how I approached it. And, you know, when I changed things, it was all to in response to that mentality. I wish everybody, frankly, out there who has any, you know, creative impulses would have a chance, because you know I think every DM out there is sort of a frustrated author, or game designer. We just don't have the time, and I have the time while I was working. So I consider myself blessed to have had the opportunity to do it, and I think I've been able to put something together here that I really hope, you know, if I bought it on the other end, I would have said, yeah, this is a cool product. You know, I'm going to use this. You know, maybe I'll run the whole thing. Maybe I'll steal a couple of ideas. Maybe I'll steal this, you know, whatever, and drop it into my campaign world. You know, I think that's the way I approached it, and I really hope that for those people who buy it, they see that.
Well, I know after releasing this, hopefully we get you get a few more from us, and I know there's a couple of the guys in my group. One guy in particular, every time he goes to GaryCon, he plays at Bill Webb's table as much as he can, so I imagine he will be excited for this specifically. Listeners, thank you very much for sitting down with us and listening, or whether you're sitting down or not, thank you for listening regardless. Check it out. It's under Necromancer Games. It's let's get the exact title. It's on Kickstarter as Necropolis, an epic adventure in the desert sands. Or so if you just search Necromancer Games or Necropolis, an epic adventure in the desert sands, you will find it. And as long as you get there before August 21st, it is good to go. You're well outside the time for the early starters at this point, obviously. But there looks like almost all the reward tiers still have plenty left on them, including the nice leather bounds, digital assets, and they're only unlocking more and more stretch goals. So the more of your friends you get in, the more cool stuff you get, too. And quite frankly, one of the things that I really like is the fact that you guys made custom GM screens for this adventure. Like, that is a really cool concept of, yeah, like, okay, having a lot of those little mechanics so it's easier on the GM.
Absolutely. But,
thank you for listening, and thank you for joining us. Everybody, thank have you. A good day.
Shield Bash is made in association with Knights of the Octagon and Farmageddon Gaming Convention. Find us online at shieldbash.net, on Facebook at Shield Bash, on Twitter at Bash Shield, and on YouTube at Shield Bash. Music by Lee Rosevere. Serpent Skull and Pathfinder are the property of Paizo Publishing Incorporated. Leave a comment on iTunes for a chance to hear us read it out on the podcast. Questions and comments can be sent to shieldbashpodcast@gmail.com.